Okay. Well, I'm disappointed in this audience, not your quality or your numbers. The fact that most of you are younger than I am, and I was going to ask the audience to dig into its memories. This paper's not a special creation, it's in a state of continuous evolution. Its focus at present is on a number of think pieces and publications by church and missionary leaders, clerical and lay. And my source material is more exclusively Anglican than some of us might wish. But I've got a few tentative conclusions and some leading questions about how church and missionary elites perceived events and trends in 1960, Africa's year of destiny, and how they educated their congregations and supporters about them. What I really want to know is more about ordinary Christians heard about and thought about Africa, and about how news from Africa featured in sermons and public intercessions. I was quite a precocious child, but I'm not so precocious that I took much notice of these events at the time, and I was hoping that there would be somebody here who was old enough to remember. Well, for those of you who aren't Africanists, what's so special about 1960? One reason for my picking this starting point is that the only similar study I know, John Stewart's chapter, Speaking for the Unvoiced, British Missionaries and Aspects of African Nationalism, 1949-1959, in Missions, Nationalism and the End of Empire, edited by Brian Stanley and Elaine Noe, a book based on a conference that was held in Cambridge some years back. That study ends the previous year. And then a glance at the handout will show you the other reasons. 1960 was the year in which no less than 17 African countries, mostly Francophone, gained their independence. The year in which Harold Macmillan made his famous Wind of Change speech. At the conclusion of an African tour, he told an unsmiling audience in the South African Parliament that the wind of change is blowing through the continent. Whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact. And 1960 was the year in which the Sharpeville massacre set off a wave of revulsion against apartheid South Africa. 1960 is Africa's year of destiny, and already the march to political freedom is on and will not be stopped until all the pent-up emotions have found their release in some sort of satisfaction. That was the editorial of Outpost, the organ of the Commonwealth and Continental Church Society, in its third issue of May to June 1960. The lead article in the sixth issue, November to December that year, reinforced the message. If the world as we know it survives the 20th century, the year 1960 will be noted in the history books as one of the most stirring years of all time. Who, even 5 years ago, could have foreseen the extraordinary change that has taken place in Africa? The sudden and unexpected transformation in French Africa, the tragedy of the Congo, the political developments and racial awakening in East and Central Africa, the emergence of new nations in West Africa, including Nigeria, the largest numerically and the most mature politically of the new African communities, and now the South Africa referendum. After the explorer, the missionary, the soldier, the trader, the settler, the administrator, comes politician. In his anniversary address for the Church Missionary Society, its president, the highly influential Sir Kenneth Grubb, who was also chair of the House of Laity in the Church Assembly and who had good links to both Whitehall and to business, told his audience, "This year, 1960, is a year of years for Africa, a year of Africa's destiny." I think destiny is the most overworked word in all of this discourse. Nigeria, the Congo and Somalia achieve their independence. Kenya and Sierra Leone take farther strides towards it. The future of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland is in question. Strife in a tragic and terrible form has erupted into violence in the Union of South Africa. Nor are other parts of Africa, perhaps less known to us in this country, exempt from the sign of changes to come. Grubb's own missionary experience had been in South America, but as the 60s progressed, he maintained his and CMS's commitment to Africa. In his autobiography, Crips of Power, published in 1971, he wrote, "The approach of independence in the parts of Africa where the society worked entailed additional responsibilities. As president, I gave regular receptions to delegates who arrived for the constitutional conferences. I also made a point of inviting individual delegates to lunch or dine with me in a club of standing, ensuring that they would not be embarrassed and would receive exactly the same courtesies as I extended to any of my acquaintances. The society's reception for the Kenya delegates played, so I've been told on the highest authority, a decisive part in avoiding a breakdown of the conference. All the participants met on an informal footing just at the time when they had begun to refuse to meet around the conference table, and a crucial corner was turned." Grubb went on to attend most of the independence ceremonies for West and East Africa. And he's got a lovely account of watching the flags come down and the new flags go up and the aeroplane bypasses and the mass choirs and so on. These great occasions were fitly, indeed magnificently done. Britain herself has never known an independence. Our fathers worshipped their stocks and stones, were conquered by Roman, Saxon and Norman, mingled with their conquerors, and grew up through war and peace and civil strife. We formed and framed our laws and institutions across the centuries. The nations of Africa were all through the early decades of the CMS, slavery and dire cruelty stalked the land, have now moved into this solemn and joyous responsibility, and all of us rejoice with them. Church and mission have played their part. The new leaders paid generous tribute to their work. For our part, we were glad with our African brethren, knowing that happy is the nation whose God is the Lord. All this was the decorative aspect, but after the dance and the feast comes the cold reality of dawn. The long road of nation building winds uphill to the very end. General Secretary of the CMS when Grubb was president was of course Max Warren, and he too took a close interest in Africa. His book, Challenge and Response, Six Studies in Missionary Opportunity, based on lectures delivered in America, was published by SPCK in 1960. Lecture two was entitled, What is Happening in Africa? It begins with a warning about generalising about Africa and Africans, and introduces the concept of Ubuntu. Well, Ubuntu is a fashionable concept now, but in 1960, I think Warren may have been one of the first Western commentators to pick up on it. He discussed industrial development, political development, what he called the stampede for education, and the danger of African reaction to European racism and exploitation. He drew heavily on Van der Post, Alan Paton, and the Carruthers report on the psychology of Mau Mau, to emphasise what he saw as the Africans' justified search for means of self-affirmation. He called for Africans to be entrusted with leadership. He was talking primarily about church leadership, but it's not much of a leap to see this as encouragement for self-government. And he encouraged Africans to express their faith in authentically African ways. He revisited these themes in Problems and Promises in Africa Today, the Lichfield Cathedral Lectures in Divinity for 1963. Followers of a rather different style of mission and evangelism were also left in no doubt of Africa's importance. We believe God directed the launching of this undertaking at the opening of Africa's Year of Destiny. We hope to be able to make some contribution to Africa's Hour of Decision, Billy Graham announced as he set off on a preaching tour that would take him to 16 cities and 19 countries, Liberia, Ghana, Nigeria, Southern Rhodesia, Northern Rhodesia, Tanganyika, Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, and Ethiopia. South Africa was not included because Billy Graham insisted on unsegregated meetings. And at the other end of the Christian spectrum, though I have yet to research Catholic voices, in March 1960, the first black African of modern times gained his cardinal's hat. The long-lived, he lived from 1912 to 1997, Lorian Rugu-Banwa of Tanganyika, whose earlier career was distinguished not only by study in Rome, but by missionary service in West Africa. John Stuart, in his study of the slightly earlier period, generalised thus. Some British missionaries, mostly Anglo-Catholics, chose in the main to tread warily. Some, almost invariably Scottish, and I regret that there's not more about the Scots in this paper, trod, one might say, more rashly. While some others, Anglican evangelicals, acted with more than a degree of calculation. Of course, their responses varied, as the societies themselves varied, and as conditions differed within the territories where they operated. He has also suggested that there was a generation gap, younger missionaries tending to be far more sympathetic to the cause of African nationalism than their older colleagues. Marjorie Perham, who was not only the universally accepted authority on colonial Africa, but also a devout High Anglican and president of the UMCA, gave an address to a World Council of Churches study conference, recording her impression that British governments are a little bewildered by the support, in some instances the very new support, which the churches are now giving to the forces of nationalism. She drew attention to the honourable record of missionaries and churchmen in standing up for African rights in matters of land and labour, and interpreted the will of this conference, where perhaps we can offer the latest representative evidence of Christian opinion upon our subject, to be wholeheartedly, if only implicitly, in favour of the early independence of colonial peoples. This address was reprinted in Frontier, the organ of the World Dominion Press and the Christian Frontier Council. The self-description of the press and the council ran as follows. The Christian Frontier Council is a fellowship of 30 or 40 lay men and women who hold responsible positions in secular life and have met regularly for the past 16 years to explore with each other the practical implications of their faith. They include members of all denominations. The World Dominion Press, founded in 1924, exists to study and promote the growth of self-support, self-propagation, and self-government in the newer Christian churches of the world, and for the survey of unevangelised areas and peoples. Sir Kenneth Grubb, who keeps coming up here, was the chairman of the Board of Management. I'm not sure of Frontier's circulation or its influence, but it has some big name contributors: Newbegin, Nynam, Bent Sunkler, Stephen Neal, Kenneth Cragg, Joseph Oldham among them, and it carried numerous articles on nationalism, the church, and independence in Africa. Between 1959 and 1962, it published, among other articles, Max Warren on Missions and Nations, the editor's comments on Central Africa, and here's a good sample of this. This is John Lawrence. If I were a black African, I suspect that I should become bitterly anti-white. If I were a white African, I think I should have a morbid fear of black African nationalism. I feel sure that if I had to make decisions in Africa, I would make the kind of mistakes that are, in fact, made in some circumstances. Missionaries are likely to be better informed than governments about public opinion, and I give great weight to the considered views of the Church of Scotland concerning Nyasaland. There are articles on the Belgian Congo, on French West Africa, apartheid, African paradoxes, the Bishop of Bloemfontein on the South Africa I would like to see, Marjorie Perham on colonial government in countries of rapid social change, Kenneth Grubb on Sir Francis Ebiam, KBE, as a profile of an African leader. Ebiam was governor of Eastern Nigeria, a medical doctor and a prominent Christian layman. The Church and Politics in Kenya, the Human Obligation in Nigeria, the Situation in Algeria, and Christian Contribution to Nation Building. Here's Kenneth Grubb again on the Church and the New Nations. My own view is that the process of decolonisation has gone on too fast, but that is better than going on too slowly, and the pressures have been very great. This may be an unpopular view. I am for decolonisation, or the growth into independence, and I am critical of certain aspects of colonialism. But we have tried to push things as they are too quickly into what they ought to be. Africa has been fortunate, not only in its Livingstones and Mary Slessors, but in the holy and humble men of heart who have served Christ in colonial administrations. Given that I've done earlier work on the British Colonial Service, I'm particularly struck by this last reference. And the Colonial Service was still, in the late 1950s, recruiting men, and a very few women, and telling them that they would have a career for life. African independence came much earlier than almost any one of them anticipated. But I'm digressing. My reading of a so far limited sample of material certainly suggests that missionary leaders and opinion setters had pondered and prayed the implications of African independence. They had some fears and reservations, but in public print were almost invariably optimistic. This may be not unconnected to the fact that, as Hugh MacLeod points out, anti-colonial movements that were often anti-Christian in Asia were seldom so in Africa. Most nationalist leaders were the product of mission schools and often wore their Christian identity proudly. Well on into the decade, Bishop Russell, recently retired from Zanzibar after 34 years in East Africa, spoke of decolonisation as the reverberation of the preaching of the gospel, God's teaching of men and nations to stand on their own feet and work as free men and not as needy children. 10 years earlier, the Synod of Southwest Tanganyika passed unanimously a resolution of sympathy with the Tanganyika African National Union's aim of self-government. UNCA's final published report in 1961 welcomed nationalism as a stirring of the soul of all Africa. Bishop Ambrose Reeves had led the opposition to the Bantu Education Act of 1954 in South Africa, which the Church Times described as a challenge to the conscience of all church people. And if other bishops in Southern Africa held back, the SPG, already in the late 50s, was funding anti-apartheid activism and advocacy. The International Review of Mission published numerous articles on Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. T.A. Beetham, writing in 1957, the year of Ghana's independence, on the Church in Africa faces 1957, was not at all atypical. He quotes a Ghanaian nationalist newspaper. While we cry ourselves hoarse after self-government and Africanization, the Church is silently but surely are laying solid foundations for these. That is why we labour and trouble ourselves. Africanisation and self-government come smoothly and naturally to the churches. It is the gift of God. But Beetham admits, those of us inside the church know that it does not come smoothly. Those of us who have been in the position of leaders are startled from time to time at the discovery of unconscious motives which keep us clinging to power. Large share in education, large proportion of the coming generation passing through the church's hands, gave it a great opportunity, but also a false sense of security. He also discusses marriage questions, ministerial training, relations with Islam, problems of emergent leadership, building multiracial and multilingual church communities, and the scandal of Christian disunity. Themes which recur in much Christian writing of the period. Central Africa, the journal of the UMCA, was of course particularly concerned with developments in the Central African Federation, but it kept a watching brief on Africa as a whole. In 1959, it reprinted an article on the African Revolution from The Economist. Because all Christian thinking about Africa must be fully aware of the immense changes which are taking place so rapidly and of the forces which are moulding the lives and hopes of all the people of Africa, whether black or brown or white. Christianity is concerned with persons both severally and in community, and always with persons in the circumstances in which they live. The church in Africa needs to bring salvation in such a situation, and our prayers must be directed to that end. The UMCA summer school at Great Malvern in August that year was on the theme Revolution. Revolution in Africa, and revolution at home. The publicity stated, "The future, of course, is in God's hand, but he has chosen us to bear witness at a time when Africa is facing many complex social, industrial and political problems. Africa is indeed in a state of revolution. We shall hear from those who have recently returned from Africa, and also from those who are endeavouring to revolutionise members of the church in this country into an awareness of their responsibilities." John V. Taylor from CMS gave the UNCA anniversary address in 1959. In itself, that's an interesting case of the high and low Anglican missionary societies coming together. In it, he referred to the 9 months he had spent in Northern Rhodesia the previous year, as well as to his previous experience in Uganda. He said, "In not many years from now, more than two-thirds of Africa, an area equal to Europe and the United States combined, is going to be under the control of independent governments. In face of that fact, ignorance or indifference are sheer folly. But for the Christian, ignorance is more than folly. It is sin." It's possible to discern a range of sympathies in Central Africa. I suspect that not everyone relished all that talk of revolution. Neither the Wind of Change speech nor Sharpeville is directly discussed in its pages. And the final editorial of 1960 is rather dampening. How many of us find ourselves full of indignation over the evils of apartheid or colour discrimination? How easy it is to condemn those who practice these things and see the folly as well as the sinfulness of these policies. Yet we are warned against judging others, and very often indignation over something the other side of the world is a way of distracting attention from our own shortcomings. Meanwhile, CMS was keeping Africa's profile high. Max Warren had visited West Africa in 1957 to celebrate the centenary of the mission in southeast Nigeria. He went again in 1964. He concluded his report on the second visit, "In conclusion, we would both wish to say that we came back from West Africa enormously enheartened and encouraged, having seen a church which was facing mountainous difficulties and not a few dangers with great courage, and which, so it seemed to us, is in a deeper measure than was obvious in 1957, a church looking outward to the unfinished task and drawing upon the resources of the divine grace to enable it to fulfil its ministry." Sir Kenneth Grubb continued to devote the main part of his CMS anniversary addresses to developments in Africa. As in his autobiography, he was particularly proud of CMS